Prisoners wrongly detained by Russia are back on American soil.
On the tarmac to greet them, U.S. President Joe Biden, Vice President Kamala Harris, and their families.
Plus, Russian forces are pushing forward in Ukraine.
Analysts say that delays in the provision of military aid to Ukraine from the West, especially the United States, led to delays in equipping newly created Ukrainian units and re-equipment of those who were already fighting. It appears that Russian forces are taking advantage of this weakness to gradually make tactical gains.
And later, Japan and the U.S. upgrade their defense relationship, and China is looking to Africa for agricultural imports. Today is Friday, August 2nd, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. The big story today continues to be Thursday's historic prisoner swap between several Western countries and Russia. The deal saw American journalists Evan Gershkovich and Alsu Kermasheva freed, along with others, including former Marine Paul Whelan and Putin critic Vladimir Kara-Murza. There was joy and relief at a military base in Maryland, just outside of Washington, D.C., late Thursday night, when a plane touched down and the three Americans unjustly detained in Russia stepped on U.S. soil again. Their families, President Joe Biden, Vice President Kamala Harris, and a lot of reporters were there to greet them. VOA's press freedom editor Jessica Jurit has the story.
A moment long awaited for. Three Americans released Thursday from Russian detention, arriving at Joint Base Andrews just outside Washington. On the tarmac to greet them, U.S. President Joe Biden, Vice President Kamala Harris, and their families. An historic deal involving several allies secured the release of 16 political prisoners held in Russia. Their price? 8 individuals requested by the Kremlin. Photos documented the journey home. Wall Street Journal correspondent Evan Gershkovich and Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty editor Alsu Kermasheva with former U.S. Marine Paul Whelan, pictured on a plane and speaking with Biden on the phone. Gershkovich's newsroom erupted in cheers earlier in the day at news of their colleague's safe return. The Moscow correspondent had spent close to 500 days in a Russian prison. Jason Conti is general counsel at Wall Street Journal parent company Dow Jones.
You don't realize quite how emotional it all is until you have this release, you know, both his release, but also just this physical release almost to see him free. And people realize, you know, wow, you've actually been feeling quite worked up and pent up and upset over what's been going on.
Similar scenes greeted Kermasheva's newsroom at RFERL in Prague. Her husband, who works at the network, spoke of the family's months-long ordeal. Pavel Boterin is Kermasheva's husband.
Right now, we're overwhelmed with emotions. We're still trying to process what actually happened to us today. Being in the White House, hearing Alsu's voice from the Oval Office next to President Biden, that was something very special. But it's been an incredibly difficult year for us.
From their reunion under the media gaze, the families are expected to travel on to a facility in Texas to receive support and privacy while they adjust to their return. For Liam Scott at Joint Base Andrews, Jessica Jurit, VOA News.
Thursday's prisoner swap was historic for its size, the sheer number of people being exchanged, as well as for its scope. Some 7 countries were involved. It's a testament to international relationships, diplomacy, and perseverance. My colleague Lori London spoke with Nicole Bibbins-Sadaka. She's the interim president of Freedom House.
We are really grateful to the governments that worked very hard to secure their release. And we recognize that this just shows the difference between what democracies and autocracies are doing these days. Countries that have governments like they have in Russia and Belarus have been holding innocent people, many of whom are journalists, human rights activists, have been holding them as prisoners with no crimes committed. And they've been holding them for years in many cases, whereas the democracy democracies that we saw over the last number of months and years to secure the release are committed to ensuring that innocent people can be reunited with their families and be returned to freedom.
This was months and months of negotiations at the highest levels of governments. It was about 2 years in the making, and one of the sticking points was Russia's demand for the release of a hitman, an assassin, Vadim Krasikov. This man was being held in Germany, and Germany didn't want to release him. What does it say about the importance of relationship building and alliances?
I do think the important takeaway is that democracies saw that their citizens or others that even weren't their citizens were being held unjustly because they were journalists, because they were human rights activists, because they were doing the things which all of us do every day, which is critique our government, ask for a different government, ask for our voices to be respected and to be heard, to actually have free and fair elections. Those are things which we do every day in a democracy. And here you have democratic governments coming together to say, we will not stand for people who are exercising their universal rights to be thrown in prison, mistreated for years and years and years, and they fought to get them out. And I think that's the good news story of the day. I think it's also very important to remember how many people are being held still in Russia, in Belarus, in many, many, many countries around the world where governments are trying to silence democracy and human rights activists, journalists, women's rights activists, because they are demanding their rights. And the way that these autocratic governments respond is by throwing them in jail.
Do you think that deals like this give countries that want to silence people more leverage to potentially hold them as bargaining chips? Does it always have to be? Is it just not possible to do these kinds of deals without some sort of swap? Obviously, they felt like the safety and well-being of these people were worth it. But does it encourage countries to do more of that?
Yeah, I'll leave it to others to analyze, you know, the parity of the swap. But I think the most important thing that we're focused on right now is just welcoming these individuals home and using it also as a moment to spotlight what Russia and other autocratic regimes have been doing for years and years to repress their own people, to repress other human rights activists, to repress foreigners who are there visiting the way many of us do to many countries. And I think that's the most important story today is what can we all be doing at this point to try and push for the release of the hundreds of thousands of people who are languishing in prisons around the world for simply exercising their universal rights that all of us who live in democracies are able to do every day.
Lori Lunzen hosts Issues in the News here on The Voice of America. She was speaking with Nicole Bibbins-Sadaka. She's the interim president of Freedom House. Changing gears now, we go to the Middle East, where the funeral of Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh took place in Qatar on Friday, following his assassination 2 days earlier in Tehran, just one in a series of killings of senior figures in the Palestinian militant group as the war between Israel and Hamas rages on in Gaza. Mourners at the ceremony included Khalid Mishal, who is tipped to be the new Hamas leader, other senior Hamas officials, and Qatar's emir, Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani, also attended. He'll be buried in the city of Lusail, north of Doha. Iran and Hamas have both accused Israel of carrying out the killing and have pledged to retaliate. Israel has not claimed responsibility for the death, nor have they denied it. And in Ukraine, Russian forces appear to have the advantage in Pokrovsk. Anna Chernikova, our correspondent in Kyiv, has the latest.
In its latest report, the Institute for the Study of War stated that Russian forces continue to advance slowly and steadily in the area of Pokrovsk in the eastern Donetsk region, largely due to the lack of Ukrainian manpower and the difficult terrain in the area northwest of Avdiivka. Analysts say that delays in the provision of military aid to Ukraine from the West, especially the United States, led to delays in equipping newly created Ukrainian units and re-equipment of those who were already fighting. It appears that Russian forces are taking advantage of this weakness to gradually make tactical gains. Geolocation images released on August 1st show that Russian troops have advanced closer to Pokrovsk. Ukrainian and Russian sources also report that Russian troops captured several more settlements. However, Institute for the Study of War predicts that the advance of Russian forces in the direction of Pokrovsk is likely to slow down further as Russian forces approach the line of larger and more urbanized settlements. Analysts point out that Ukrainian forces are now significantly more exhausted and depleted than they were early the year when Russian forces captured Avdiivka, which was also well fortified. They believe Russian forces are likely to continue to advance tactically. Earlier, President Volodymyr Zelensky said that after the unsuccessful offensive on Kharkiv, the Russian army concentrated the largest amount of equipment and personnel in the area surrounding Pokrovsk. Oleksandr Sirsky, the commander-in-chief of the Ukrainian armed forces, also said that the Russian army continues to focus its efforts near Pokrovsk. In his evening address, President Zelensky announced the preparation of new security agreements and arrangements with partners, which will be announced later in August. The president also confirmed the preparation of the visits of the leaders of the partner countries to Ukraine. Zelensky emphasized that it is highly important to ensure the stability of Ukraine for years, and this will be a guarantee for the country's greater opportunities given the existing challenges and threats. The president of Ukraine defined the provision of the defense forces, the state budget, and the social stability of Ukraine as a key task. Meanwhile, Forbes journalist David Hambling reported in his recent article that in July, Ukraine launched more long-range strike drones than Russia did, for the first time. Based on information from open sources, he estimated that last month Russia attacked Ukraine with 426 drones, while Ukraine attacked Russia with 520 drones. VOA cannot verify this information independently. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
You're listening to Flashpoint, Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Japan and the United States have strengthened their security agreement. We'll have that story in a moment. First, though, we're staying in Europe. About 140 athletes are part of Ukraine's team at the Paris Olympics, and all of them carry memories of the war back home. They gather at Ukraine House in Paris, a place that welcomes visitors, fans, athletes, and dignitaries. Some athletes have been directly caught up in the war, others have family members fighting on the front lines, and some worry from afar in European countries where they've settled for training. VOA's Lisa Bryant is in Paris.
For Ukrainians here in Paris, the Olympics are a very different battlefield. Matvey Bidny is Ukraine's acting sports minister.
It's very important. It's very important to show over the world Ukrainian resilience, the Ukrainian will to win.
Even here at the country's Olympic Pavilion in northeastern Paris, it's hard to forget Russia's war in Ukraine.
There are a lot of sports facilities damaged, more than 520 sports facilities damaged or destroyed, totally destroyed. What's more important, the mental condition of our athletes. When you always under the threat and your loved one always under the threat shelling attack, on killing, on occupation.
Minister Bidny says more than 3,000 athletes and trainers have taken up weapons. Nearly 500 have died in the war against Russia. Others, like judo athlete Bogdan Yadov, have family on the front lines.
My father defended our country. I really want see my father because 2 years I didn't see my father. So it's really hard to live in war. But I'm always pray for this this war ends soon.
Badminton player Polina Barova lives and trains in Italy, but Ukraine isn't far from her mind.
It's always very hard mentally to prepare, to understand, to accept, and to go and fight, because especially when you go on court, you want to show the best for Ukraine. You want to make a country proud. You want to make people proud of you.
Politicians, but also fans from all over, are coming here to support Ukraine's athletes. Like Jesper Lindholt, who lives in Kyiv. His family lives outside Ukraine.
I'm very happy to be in this place and see how they also carry the message, and the two-sided message, to be part of the world community while still fighting. On behalf of world community, Ukraine is fighting.
Ukraine's team has already won Olympic medals here, giving Ukrainians back home something to cheer about. Lisa Bryant, VOA News, Paris.
The United States has moved to significantly strengthen its alliances in the Indo-Pacific amid a seeming security threat from China, including a major upgrade of its military command in Japan. Just how ready are the United States and its allies to act if conflict erupts? Henry Ridgewell reports from Tokyo.
The United States has around 54,000 troops deployed in Japan, most of them in Okinawa. The Kadena Air Base is America's largest in the Pacific. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin held talks with their Japanese counterparts Sunday and announced a major shift in defense relations. Secretary Austin.
United States will upgrade the U.S. Forces Japan to a joint force headquarters with expanded missions and operational responsibilities.
The upgraded command will be led by a three-star general, says Foreign Policy Institute President Kunihiko Miyake.
That means that Americans are serious. Americans are really serious about fighting a war with Japan. Against whom? I don't know. I don't know. Whoever wants to change the status quo by force, we may have to fight.
The move is designed to complement Japan's new Joint Operations Command, according to Grant Newsham, a senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy.
It's a good first step, is how I would put it, towards getting the Americans and the Japanese in a position where they can actually fight together. But what remains to be seen, and this is important, is how much authority will it have? What units will be assigned to it? What responsibility will it have in the event of a contingency?
Japan last year announced plans to double defense spending to 2% of gross domestic product by 2027. Newsham says the Japanese military needs a huge investment in recruitment, weapons, and logistics, and that's just the start.
How are you going to actually link up with the Americans to fight? What have you already done? Have you done the necessary planning and training so that you can just fall right in and deal with a real-world contingency?
There are fears such a contingency is dangerously close. The US and Japan have labeled China the greatest strategic challenge facing the region amid Beijing's rapid military buildup around the South China Sea and Taiwan. U.S. officials say Washington is seeking to interconnect its regional alliances, creating a lattice framework to protect Indo-Pacific security. Again, Foreign Policy Institute President Kunihiko Miyake.
Of course, we cannot have a NATO-type collective alliance system because we have a different historical background. But what we needed to have is the multi-layered security arrangements or dialogue or whatever.
The Philippines is a key part of that alliance. The U.S. announced a $500 million military aid package for Manila Tuesday. Grant Newsham.
For this so-called lattice work of a range of alliances and agreements that the Americans have tried to put together, with whom can they do a real-world short-notice operation? That means if you had to go out and really do something for real, like fight, who could they do it with? And that is a very, very short list.
Beijing denies that it poses a threat to Indo-Pacific security. A Chinese foreign ministry spokesperson Tuesday urged the US and Japan to abandon what it called a Cold War mentality. Russia on Wednesday said the United States and Japan appeared to be preparing for armed conflict, adding that Moscow was consulting with China and North Korea on how best to respond. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, Tokyo.
And finally today, China is expanding its imports of agricultural products from Africa in an effort to address a trade imbalance and as a way of diversifying global food chains amid geopolitical tensions. Kate Bartlett visits South Africa's rural Limpopo province, where avocado farmers are getting ready to export their products to the Chinese for the first time.
This fruit is so valuable, it's been dubbed green gold, and it's destined for China.
At the end of the BRICS summit last year, the deal was signed to export avocados to China. So we now have access to China. But there's been a big process in between to meet all the requirements of the protocol that was agreed to. And we're very close now to being able to send the first shipment to China.
Derek Duncan is the CEO of a South African Fruit Growers Association and has been working with Chinese inspectors to open so-called green lanes to get avocado exports off the ground. China has long been the African continent's biggest trade partner, but the Asian giant exports some $60 billion more in goods to Africa each year than it imports. In South Africa's case, China exported $11 billion more than it imported in 2022, the most recent year for which figures are available.
Because there's been a strong impetus from the Chinese as well to make sure that this deal happens, because they're aware of that trade imbalance and that they need to be taking more exports from South Africa.
South Africa also exports its agricultural produce to the EU and US, which are its third and fourth largest markets respectively, behind the African continent and China. Many of South Africa's agricultural products benefit from tariff-free access to the US market under Washington's African Growth and Opportunity Act. The avocado deal with Beijing was made last year when South Africa hosted Chinese President Xi Jinping on a state visit alongside the summit of the BRICS Group of Emerging Economies. At the time, South Africa urged China to address the trade deficit. Experts say China is also expanding its imports of semi-processed agriculture from Africa to ensure food security and avoid price inflation. Lauren Johnston is an associate professor of China Studies at the University of Sydney.
Another kind of bigger geostrategic reason for the push on food exports is similar to kind of diversify the global agricultural supply chain. You know, you've had this pressure on China. You've got the soybean pressure from the US. You've got different pressures and trade tensions between Australia and China.
As part of its agricultural push in Africa, China also imports soybeans, citrus, wine, and rooibos tea from South Africa, avocados and tea from Kenya, and coffee from Rwanda and Ethiopia. China's new ambassador to South Africa, Wu Peng, has promised measures are being taken to speed up the export of more agricultural products to China. The potential of this is huge, says Clive Garrett, marketing manager for ZZ2, a South African farming conglomerate which will soon be exporting its avocados to China.
Until October in 2023, South Africa really could only export to Europe, a little bit to the Middle East. But now, since then, we've had Japan, China, and India open to us. And these are very exciting markets because the per capita consumption in these markets is still incredibly low. So we see huge opportunities of going into these markets.
According to industry estimates, there are some 300 million people in China earning enough to buy imported fruit. That can only be good news for farmers and workers here in this bucolic mountain town. Kate Bartlett, VOA News, Tzaneen, Limpopo, South Africa.
And that's going to wrap it up for today. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until next week, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.